We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. Or visit preborn.com.
The feature-length documentary Culture Warrior, Don Wildman and the Battle for Decency, premiering November 11th, chronicles the life and ministry of Don Wildman. It takes you through the founding of the National Federation for Decency, what has become AFA. It's a call to stand firm for righteousness and shows how that resolve can make a huge difference in our world.
If we lose this cultural war, we're going to have a hedonistic, humanistic society.
Find out more and watch the trailer at culturewarrior.movie.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government.
I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Monday, March 10th already. We are in the month of March, and I can't even speak this morning because, like you, I did not get my extra hour of sleep. We have sprung forward into daylight saving time, and I really hope that Congress does deal with this. I know that President Trump said from the Oval Office last week that because it is a very divisive issue, apparently, in America, what is wrong with us? This should not be a divisive issue. We should all say, yes, just fix the clocks. It is fine. But because it is such a divisive issue, then half the people will be upset if he does something. Half the people will be upset if he doesn't. So, you know, it's kind of, you know, whatever. So that to me means you can kind of do whatever. And you know that half the people will be upset. Well, I am in the half of the people that I'm very upset that I had to wake up when it was dark outside after having had, you know, some lovely mornings over the last few months. But nevertheless, we have sprung forward, and I hope that you have all had your coffee this morning and you are enjoying barreling towards spring and summer, which is actually very exciting. It's one of the favorite seasons. I mean, I love Christmas, and I always say that's my favorite time of the year, but I really love summer too and spring, and it's just amazing. So I love all the seasons for their various things. But let's get down to the news. So a CBS reporter visited the border and found no illegal immigrants and was totally shocked. This is a viral clip online and from a CBS report, and this is actually hilarious. So CBS says on a recent afternoon, A CBS News, accompanied by U.S. Border Patrol agent Claudio Herrera, accompanied him along this rugged stretch of the U.S. southern border. Herrera said the area located within Border Patrol's sprawling El Paso sector has long been a hotspot for the illicit movement of people and drugs. But the situation there has changed markedly in recent weeks. And Charlie Kirk, our friend over at TPUSA, said the CBS border and immigration reporter is shocked that he didn't see a single illegal during his trip to the border. This is the quote from that reporter. We did not see a single migrant or asylum seeker. And typically when we go to the border, we see at least one group of people trying to illegally cross into the U.S. We saw soldiers, Border Patrol agents, National Guard troops, vehicles and barriers, but no migrants. The border is officially closed. And Charlie Kirk says, thank you, President Trump. So meanwhile, in New York, of course, the Democrats are not okay with this, and Kathy Hochul and some of the other New York officials are trying to ignore ICE, but two New York counties reportedly are ignoring Kathy Hochul and helping ICE deport migrant criminals. So this coming from the New York Post and Carrie Seropoulos, who is an associate at the Manhattan Institute, and he joins me now. So, Carrie, this is actually encouraging, I think, that at least two New York counties are just ignoring the governor in favor of what is clearly within the jurisdiction of federal law and ICE to deport migrant criminals. So what exactly is going on? And good morning.
Good morning, Jenna. Thanks for having me on. Yes, I think it's definitely encouraging to see several counties and several committed leaders in New York State saying that, you know, we've had enough. We have a migrant crime problem. We have a problem of illegal aliens living in our district committing crimes. And if the governor of New York is not going to help us deal with that, we're going to deal with it ourselves. So the two counties are Rensselaer County, which is upstate New York, and Nassau County out on Long Island, a suburb of New York City. And the sheriffs and county executives of both counties, Bruce Blakeman, who's been very prominent on other issues like, biological men playing in women's sports. Both of them have stood up and said, we're going to enroll our law enforcement agencies in this program to cooperate with the federal government. It's called 287G. This is a program that was actually established in the 90s, actually by the Clinton administration, if you can believe it. So it's been around a long time and really took off after 9/11. Trump administration has placed a priority on enrolling more counties after the Biden administration basically slow walked other counties trying to join. But what it says is your local sheriff's department, your local law enforcement agency, you can enroll in this program. Your officers, their local employees, their local law enforcement officers, but we're going to deputize them to run immigration checks on people who are brought in for other crimes to county jails. And if we find that they're in the country illegally, we're going to alert ICE and we're going to keep them here until ICE can come and pick them up, and we're going to hand them over to ICE. So that's the program they've engaged in. And I think it's encouraging to see leaders, who are not necessarily state level, but who are in New York, who are in a very blue state, saying we've had enough.
Yeah, and so really fascinating background here. So are these two counties more Republican or a little bit more red than the blue state of New York overall?
Yeah, Rensselaer County is upstate. That's definitely red territory. That's Trump country, or as close as you can get in New York. Nassau County historically is slightly more red, but it's one of the most populous counties in New York outside of New York City. It's been trending red over the years. It's definitely, you know, Lee Zeldin is from Long Island, new EPA administrator. Long Island has continued to swing towards Republicans over the last couple of years. And Rensselaer County did it first. Rensselaer County enrolled in this program way back in 2017. Bruce Blakeman just announced it several weeks ago. Nassau County is one of the main suburbs of New York City that's engaging in this program. And it really has, you know, leaders who are committed. But even in terms of New York City, I know, you know, Eric Adams has his problems legally and otherwise. But he has also, you know, at least talked a big game about increasing cooperation with ICE. But, yeah, for the moment, it's basically restricted to slightly more Republican-leaning counties. Mm.
And this is really interesting, Carrie, because, you know, maybe some of this example in a solidly blue state, at least in terms of how the rest of America perceives it and how New York kind of flaunts itself from their statewide office level. Maybe this is some encroachment back into common sense. And when you have two of these counties, I mean, if this were happening, you know, two counties in rural Texas or Alabama, we'd just be like, okay, you know, that's obvious that these states are going to go along with, or these counties are going to go along with Trump. But when you go back, as you mentioned, with this history of, you know, this is back in the Clinton era. I mean, that's when Democrats weren't so far to the left. And you're seeing that some of these counties, then even in New York, are following this. Maybe we're kind of resetting the political map here to isolate a lot of the really extreme leftists to say, you really don't have pro-America policies at all. And this isn't just a Republican versus a Democrat thing. This is sort of the old Democrats like the Kennedys and the Tulsi Gabbards of the world. And the conservatives against the extreme left, and continuing to sort of isolate that mindset and to say you are in the extreme minority here, I think will play really well as we're heading further into toward the midterms. But in terms of just Trump advancing his agenda of mass deportations, of securing the border, how may this continue to affect the courage of perhaps other states and counties, maybe say in California?
California, you know, I'm not holding out hope. California has actually passed a statewide ban on these types of agreements. So there'd have to be some more movement in terms of that state. But I think in terms at least of New York in the Northeast, I mean, even Massachusetts, if you can believe it, Massachusetts State Corrections is enrolled in this agreement and has been for some time. So it really shows that New York has been very out of step and that other counties have to get on it. I mean, all credit to the president. Border crossings are down over 95%. And he's done a great job on that and is encouraging other counties to join this program. But, you know, when you have millions upon millions of legal aliens in this country, you know, you'd think they'd be crossing every T and dotting every I. But when people decide to commit crimes against the citizenry of this country and commit crimes against public order, that shouldn't be a political thing. It shouldn't be politically controversial to say, if you come into this country, if you're, you know, taking advantage of our hospitality, as New York has been, a quote, a hospitality city or a sanctuary city, and you take advantage of that to commit really heinous crimes in many cases, we're not going to tolerate it. And if the New York, you know, district attorneys are not going to prosecute or whatever, we're going to send you back we're going to give you a one-way ticket back to where you came from. But going back to what you were saying about the political will to do this, something like 70% of New Yorkers want stronger immigration restrictions and stronger immigration enforcement. New York has taken on more than its share of this problem, spending billions of dollars on the migrant crisis in New York. And I think New Yorkers understand now that they've seen it up close. You know, it's not just a problem that you see on the television in Texas, people coming across the border. Now that they've seen it in their cities, they understand. They understand that something has to change, and many, many New Yorkers are in favor of a more strict immigration policy. So there's broad-backed political will behind making these changes. But even outside of that, you know, who could want this? Who could want, you know, criminals running amok? It's a problem of public order. And frankly, the 287G, I would just touch on this. It's a problem of protecting our law enforcement officers. Denver, Colorado, released the video last week of an illegal alien, suspected Trende Aragua gang member, being released from the Denver County Jail on unrelated charges. ICE placed the detainer on him. They wanted to keep him in jail and pick him up from there. Denver ignored that, said, you know, this guy's getting sprung in 90 minutes. ICE had to get there and chase him down in the parking lot of the Denver County Jail just to apprehend him there. So it creates a problem for law enforcement officers having to go into the community. It makes communities less safe when you can't pick people up in jail. It makes law enforcement officers less safe when you can't pick people up in jail and, you know, make handcuff-to-handcuff transfers. And, you know, so I think that's an important piece of it, too. This public order and protecting law enforcement officers is maybe an underrated aspect of the importance of this program.
Yeah, that's a really excellent point. And I'm talking to Carrie Seropoulos, who is an associate at the Manhattan Institute. And this column that you really need to read in the New York Post is how two New York counties are ignoring Hochul and helping ICE deport migrant criminals. That's in the New York Post. And one last question for you, Carrie, before we let you go. I mean, so this is all, speaking of sanctuary cities, this is sort of setting up kind of a legal battle, because some sanctuary cities, I mean, you mentioned Denver, Colorado, you know, we've talked about California, how some of these sanctuary cities are basically saying, you know, we're refusing to work with ICE. And yet Trump has issued an executive order saying that any of these quote unquote sanctuary jurisdictions would not be eligible to receive federal grants except as deemed necessary for law enforcement purposes by the U.S. Attorney General or Secretary of Homeland Security. In terms of federal law enforcement and ICE's authority to actually deport, you know, to me, sanctuary cities are just a non-starter, and that should be obvious in the federal courts. But how do you see this showdown playing?
I think, you know, the legal battle is going to be somewhat protracted. And as you said, there's kind of, you know, ancillary concerns about federal funding. And I mean, Pam Bondi is suing the state specifically, is suing New York over the state's practice of giving driver's license, of attempting to enroll illegal aliens with driver's licenses without proof of citizenship. And so, you know, that's a separate concern that's important. It's going to have to be hashed out both in the courts and politically, again, with Trump, you know, threatening the funding of quote unquote sanctuary cities. But I think from the law enforcement angle, you know, you have the mayor of New York, Eric Adams, has said that he wants to bring back the ICE office to Rikers Island. There's a city law that would have to change in order for that to happen. But, you know, he has some leeway there to encourage ICE. And then, you know, for the counties that are surrounding New York, if New York City isn't going to want to do it, you know, there's no wall keeping people from going from, you know, the Bronx into Westchester or from Queens onto Long Island. So county executives and sheriffs from outside the city can do their best to contain that issue. And I think that's what Bruce Blakeman is doing. He's saying, you know, the federal problems, the jurisdictional problems, they're going to get worked out in court. They're going to get worked out through the political process. But what I'm saying is this is a law enforcement issue. This is a public order issue. We're not going to stand for it. And we're going to do whatever we can to keep our citizens safe and to say enough is enough.
All right. Well, Carrie Seropoulos, associate at the Manhattan Institute, thanks so much for your time and commentary this morning. It's going to be really fascinating to see how all of this plays out. And we're going to talk more about some of the lawsuits and how the left is just pushing back against some of these common sense, obviously pro-America, of just America's interests over, you know, all of these other special interests and other types of interests when we come back. But overall, I really hope that Trump succeeds, not just because it's Trump and it's conservatives and it's, you know, everything that we all voted for in the Trump mandate, but because it actually is good for America. Nations can't exist without borders. We have to be able to protect our borders, and especially when it comes to a lot of these really violent criminals, they shouldn't be here. So we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. If we have learned anything from the 2024 election, it's how important it is for us to fight, fight, fight. We also learned how desperately the left wants to fight to take babies' lives, which is why every day Preborn Ministries fights for the babies. Preborn's network of clinics are positioned in the highest abortion areas, fighting for mothers deciding between the life and death of their child. Preborn welcomes these women with God's love and offers them a free ultrasound to introduce their precious baby and hear the beautiful heartbeat. This amazing encounter gives her baby a fighting chance, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. So would you join Preborn in the fight for life? One ultrasound is just $28, and $140 will sponsor 5 ultrasounds. Babies are worth fighting for. To donate, dial #250 on your cell phone and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or you can visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible, and Preborn has a 4-star charity rating. Fight, fight, fight for the babies.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And as DOGE continues to be the operation of the Trump administration that is getting the most attention, recent polls are indicating that the majority, at least, of Americans are approving of Elon Musk and the efforts over at DOGE. So a recent CBS News and YouGov poll from late February 2025 shows that 51% approve of President Trump's efforts to cut staff and spending at government agencies, while 49% disapprove. That was actually a lot closer than I thought. And regarding DOGE's authority, 52% believe Musk and DOGE have too much power, where 33% think their authority is appropriate. So now the Campaign Legal Center and among a few other groups and also agencies are suing to stop Elon Musk and Doge. They're claiming, among other things, that Elon Musk isn't authorized to make those types of decisions. President Trump has been pretty clear that Musk is an outside advisor. And of course, presidents can obtain advice from any private sector person that they decide that they want to call up. I mean, when I worked for President Trump previously, he was really widely known to just call a lot of his friends in various private sector, get their opinions on things. That's totally fine. So where will this potentially go? Well, let's welcome in Will Chamberlain, who is the senior counsel at the Article 3 Project. And Will, overall, let's start with just Doge and Elon Musk's authority. Is what they're doing overall constitutional, or do you see that there may be some legal issues here?
I think it's pretty clearly constitutional. Elon isn't firing these people. He's an advisor. And I think, you know, maybe the average person doesn't quite, you know, it's not obvious how the White House manages these agencies, but the White House has a lot of, you know, senior advisors who work for it, some temporary, but some permanent. And, you know, when they speak with the heads of agencies, even though they're not Senate appointed, they're above the head of the agencies because they're speaking with the voice of the president. I mean, this is true. Like, I worked in state government of Florida, and I worked in the executive office of the governor. With a bunch of people who weren't confirmed by any Senate body, but they were the deputies of Governor DeSantis. And when we interacted with the agency heads, we were in charge of telling them, the agency heads, how to enact the governor's will. And so that's how I see this. So Elon isn't making these decisions. He is affecting the will of President Trump as one of President Trump's advisors.
And that makes a lot of sense with that analogy to, you know, the state level executive. And you know, this is true for the president's chief of staff, even, you know, Susie Wiles. This is true for any of the other advisors that President Trump hires that don't have to be Senate confirmed. I mean, if his entire administration, his deputies, his chief of staff, anybody coming in had to be Senate confirmed, he wouldn't have an administration. I mean, so where are, I mean, is this just kind of a smoke and mirrors kind of, you know, Elizabeth Warren, Chuck Schumer nonsense to say, you know, oh, Elon Musk wasn't confirmed by the Senate and nobody elected him. And they're just, you know, kind of yelling at the sky.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what's happening here. It's totally uncontroversial to have the White House telling, you know, these cabinet agencies what they want those cabinet agencies to do. And those conversations are not always had with the president, whose time is unbelievably scarce. You know, not only is the federal government this enormous entity with 2 million some employees, but our president is not merely the head of government. He's also the head of state. So he's in charge of handling all diplomatic protocols and diplomatic meetings and foreign heads of state, et cetera. So obviously the president's time is sufficiently scarce that he needs a lot of people around him to help him do his job, taking care that the laws are faithfully executed and acting the president's policy, since he was, you know, he's the one elected official in the executive branch. So he needs help. And he needs help in his own White House, not merely as, you know, in terms of the heads of cabinet agencies. So this is just totally a standard way for the executive branch to function. And it's functioned that way for decades, if not centuries.
Yeah, and that all totally makes sense. And yet it's interesting, just because Doge is not acting as an agency that is asking for more money from the federal government. And, you know, it's not going along with a big bureaucracy. It's actually finding waste and cutting spending. Then somehow the left is saying that that's unconstitutional. And I think it's just like many other things where the Democrats don't like the outcome. So they're using this term unconstitutional to mean not their preferred policy, but that's not the legal definition of what is or is not constitutional. It's not a matter of policy. We determine the policy in the election. We, the people, said we want Trump's policies. We don't want Kamala Harris's, period. And that's why we have elections. And so it's not a matter of should President Trump do this. As far as the law is concerned, it's can he do this? And basically what we're saying is, you know, yeah, he can. And so I want to play a quick clip here where Trump was talking this weekend on Fox News about Musk finding a lot of these fake contracts. And this maybe gives us a little bit of insight as to why the Democrats and the rhinos are so concerned about Doge. This is cut one.
He's found hundreds of billions of dollars worth of fake contracts. And I read them, just a tiny portion of them, the other night. And you'll find ultimately that the money that they sent comes back to a lot of the people that made those deals.
Interesting, right? So so with a lot of this funding cuts that are being determined by Doge, Will Chamberlain, my special guest this morning, we saw that the U.S. Supreme Court last week halted some of the spending cuts to USAID and some other things. So are we going to see that eventually the courts, I mean, that was a temporary ruling. Are we going to see that the courts will say, okay, yeah, I mean, President Trump absolutely has the authority to look at his own executive agencies and make spending cuts where appropriate?
I mean, he just obviously has that authority. I mean, not always in the sense of if there's like very specific allocations made by Congress, then no, he has to follow through on those. But, you know, Congress doesn't always do that. Congress will just hand a pile of money to an agency and give the agency the discretion on how to spend it. Well, part of that discretion is the right not to spend it at all. And I think, that, you know, under Trump, these agencies are going to do that. And just in general, what this is it's a rebellion against the idea that Republicans would get to control the functioning of the executive branch. Democrats lost the election, but they're trying to say, it's like, oh, well, you don't get to really win, right? The executive branch is staffed by our loyalists. So, you know, they're the experts. They get to determine what our government does. And you know, I think Trump may have, you know, like, gotten quite tired of that sort of attitude in his first term and is certainly not putting up with it at all in the second term.
Yeah, and there was also a piece that dropped just a few hours ago in the Daily Wire, so I'm not sure if you've seen it yet, Will, but this was an interesting investigative report that said Feds, and this is the headline, Feds can't hire for competence because Jimmy Carter said it was racist. Trump wants to fix that. So the Trump administration is seeking to overturn a prohibition on using tests to identify top federal job applicants. And a 1981 court order blocked agencies from using any test for job applicants that would result in a statistically significant difference in hiring rates between blacks and Hispanics on one hand and whites on the other. That is akin to blocking colleges from using the SAT. So now the Trump administration is set to ask the Washington, D.C. court to dissolve the 40-year ban, arguing that it illegally puts race over merit when it comes to federal hiring. And so according to the Daily Wire article, they're saying the move seems likely to prevail given the Supreme Court's ban on affirmative action and would allow Trump to permanently reshape the federal workforce into one comprised of the best and the brightest. Your initial reaction to that? I mean, I think it makes sense, and I'm glad to see that, you know, that's going along with a lot of this getting rid of DEI nonsense.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, there's, I'm completely 100% for it. Our taxpayers deserve a government that is full of people with the aptitude necessary to do their jobs effectively and efficiently. And I think, yeah, I mean, we should have a government that functions better. Government employees shouldn't be like mediocrities. And I think what ends up happening is because government is in this place that's like test-free and accountability-free, you get just generally, I mean, you get people who are seeking a, you know, an accountability-free environment to go work at, which is a scary thing.
Yeah, I'm speaking with Will Chamberlain, who is a senior counsel at the Article 3 Project. You can follow him and the Article 3 Project on X. And we're talking about Doge and all of the lawsuits that are seeking to thwart Trump's agenda, or at least, you know, kind of hobble it along rather than going at kind of this breakneck speed that Trump wants and is known for, really. So let's talk about the courts and the situation, especially over USAID. I had another attorney on last week who had a little bit different take, I think, than the majority of at least the conservative reaction on social media, that was a little annoyed at the split, and Amy Coney Barrett in particular, for, you know, siding with the halt of USAID, and just said, well, you know, this is a temporary order, and once it goes back up fully on the merits, probably it'll win. But, you know, this to me, well, and we've talked about this a lot. A lot of times the Supreme Court especially can get so bogged down in the minutiae and sort of the academic part of this that they sort of miss the forest, you know, and the trees, because they're just looking so hard at one issue. Is this something that represents maybe a yet another way that we need to seriously consider judicial reform in this country as well?
I mean, I don't know if it's, I mean, we do need some reform, especially these temporary restraining orders and the authority these judges have to issue them, if they're just going to start issuing them lawlessly, like that Judge Ali in D.C. demanding that $2 billion go out the door in a temporary restraining order and trying to shield it from appeal. And I think one of the things the Supreme Court needs to get kind of understand is that when you, judicial restraint is all well and good, but you can't be restrained when your lower courts are wildly out of pocket. That's inverting the way our judicial system is supposed to function.
Yeah, that's a great point. The higher courts are supposed to keep the lower courts at least a little bit in check. And that's why, you know, we have the levels of appeals to ensure that where there is a ruling that is clearly out of bounds or clearly erroneous, if that ends up being the standard of review, that that these are reversed. And so what was your take overall on specifically Amy Coney Barrett? And I'm sure that you saw a lot of that reaction from conservatives kind of suggesting that, you know, she wasn't really a conservative pick. I kind of see it more, you know, this is her shtick. I mean, she's very much for, I think, an extreme form of judicial restraint. And that's more the mindset of this particular vehicle and why she was in the majority. But what's your view on that?
I mean, I think they were just being too cute by half. So the really interesting thing about that ruling is they're like, they decided, you know, we're going to vacate the stay and allow the judge to go forward. And then, but in the ruling itself, it said the judge needs to identify the specific payees and account for the logistics of making these payments. I think Josh Blackman had a really good article, I think at Reason, where he pointed out, it's like, you're not vacating the stay then. You're actually changing you actually are enjoining the district court to do something new, but they were pretending they weren't. And I think, you know, it's infuriating. They're being cute. Like, they're saying, oh, we're not actually going to, like, stop the lower court judge. You know, we're not going to enjoin the lower court judge or, you know, revoke what the lower court judge did, but he's going to have to change his order somewhat. And in reality, like, if they were vacating a stay on that judge's order, what that normally means is the judge just gets, the order is back in force and it just goes forward as it was written. So it's weird. I mean, I think, you know, there's four judges who want are ready to reverse all this on jurisdictional grounds. It should obviously have been tossed on jurisdictional grounds, because you don't get to go into any random district court and sue the government on the claim that the government breached its contract with you. You go to the Court of Federal Claims, because it's an issue of sovereign immunity. You don't have the automatic right to sue the government for anything anywhere. The government has to give you permission. So, you know, this is a really straightforward case of, you know, this brand new district judge who has been practicing American law for like 5 years, maybe. He's a Canadian lawyer. Screwed up a really basic jurisdictional question, and yet the Supreme Court is like dancing in on their tiptoes trying to deal with it instead of just slapping it down and saying no.
Yeah, and that's a really great point as well. So what's your take on why they were trying to be too cute by a half? I mean, why wouldn't they just say, okay, this is a clearly really easy jurisdictional question?
I mean, there's some concern with regular order. I mean, there were like two different orders here that the judge put in, and the government only appealed the latter one. So they're like, well, we don't feel like we can properly deal with the first one. And I mean, four justices said that was silly. Obviously, you could. And I think they're just getting cute. They're trying to like play this cute moderate game where they're not seen as partisan because they're, you know, working with both sides, blah, 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 not taking aggressive action. And it just looks silly. It just looks silly. I think Alito's dissent was fundamentally right. Yeah. I think, you know, the consequences ultimately are not going to be that bad, because I think, you know, when this does come up on regular order, as it should in the next couple of weeks, I think Barrett and Roberts will be on the right side of reversing it. I don't think they, you know. Yeah.
We got a break here, Will, and that makes a lot of sense. We'll be right back with more.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And one last quick comment on the subject I was talking to Will Chamberlain on in the earlier segment about the Supreme Court getting too cute by a half, as he put it. I think that was apt. The reason that the Supreme Court and Article III judges do not have term limits is so that they are not political and they're not influenced by public sentiment. They're not influenced by political parties. And yet, when we have the Supreme Court, almost like, you know, parents, like wanting to keep everybody happy and, you know, so they don't want to just always, you know, go with the eldest child or the other, you know, so they want to make everything fair. You know, this isn't the Democrats and the Republicans coming up to the Supreme Court being like, you know, mommy, daddy, please, you know, moderate our disputes. And this is ultimately about the law. And so it doesn't matter if they politically or at least legally, whether they side with Trump 100% of the time, if he's actually constitutionally correct, that's the outcome that should happen. And if he's not, then they shouldn't side with him just because of the Trump mandate and because, you know, the majority of Americans will be annoyed or anything like that. Their mandate constitutionally is to follow the law. And so the issue that I have with the Supreme Court overall, as Will and I discussed, is that they do seem very influenced by politics. So that's why I'm personally an advocate of judicial reform. I think we need to question the lifetime term and the fact that judges don't have term limits because they are influenced by politics. So we'll talk about that, though, more on another day. But just needed to get that little rant out there for all of you today. But let's turn now to a little bit more of a somber topic. In Syria. So this coming from NBC News, hundreds of civilians have been killed in Syria. Here's what we know. More than 1,300 people have been killed in an eruption of violence in the last 72 hours, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. So let's welcome in Eric Prince, who is the founder of Blackwater. And Eric, good morning. And, you know, what led up to this and what is going on in Syria?
This is anxious score settling. When you had Assad that was in charge as an Alawite, which is a small Shia sect, lording it over the Sunnis for the last almost 50 years. Now that the Sunnis have taken over with the help of Turkish intelligence and Turkish special operations, they are settling that score against every religious minority. Remember, the new ruler of Syria is a former ISIS guy. That's who they are. He's not been reformed. He might have a better tailor and a better PR guy, but he's still every much an ISIS guy. And so the Christians, the Alawites, the Druze are really getting smashed. It's pointing towards being a genocide.
Wow. And Secretary of State Marco Rubio, according to the same NBC News piece, blamed, quote unquote, radical Islamic terrorists for the killings and urged Syria's leadership to hold them accountable. And but as you mentioned, I mean, this guy's a former ISIS member. So, you know, where is the United States then in this or not, just in terms of our Secretary of State and potentially at least Trump, you know, obviously wanting to quell that and ensure that these types of religious killings don't take place?
Well, yeah, and the real question is, who benefits from the dissolution of Syria? It's certainly the Israelis benefit because it cuts off the Shia link from Iran through Iraq all the way to Lebanon. So it cuts off the ability for Hezbollah to resupply. I don't know if the Israelis were part of the overthrow of Assad or not, but between the Turks definitely sponsoring it coming from the north and possibly the Israelis, the Christians are the ones that are paying the big price over the last months and will be doing so. It'll be it's another step in wiping out Christendom in the Middle East.
And so ultimately, what does this mean for Syria and their new leadership?
It means that the Turks with Erdogan is really trying to reassert, reestablish the Ottoman Empire. with Syria effectively just being a protectorate of theirs.
Wow. And I'm speaking with Eric Prince, who is the founder of Blackwater. And, you know, as this all is going on in Syria, and then obviously we have, you know, still going on the conflict between Hamas and Israel, and then we have Trump trying to negotiate this outcome between Ukraine and Russia. I mean, all of this on the world stage is going on in just the first couple of months of President Trump's term. Where do you see this going in terms of the world stage? And I should mention as well, there's a new Canadian prime minister, so we are officially post Justin Trudeau, which is a good thing. So Mark Carney is set to be Canada's next prime minister. Overall, on the world stage, how is this playing out? I mean, I think there are a lot of people who are very concerned for a number of reasons that we may be on the brink of World War III, and maybe also a tech war, depending on a lot of other factors. But I think there's a lot of questions that have people very concerned.
Well, really, the only risk of World War III is with Russia or with China if they decide to do something very aggressive on Taiwan. The Middle East stuff will continue to boil, and Christians will continue to suffer. So it's sad, but unfortunately it's inevitable. The area has been boiling for millennia and will probably continue to do so. I would say that the next country that is at risk of, call it Turkish expansionism, is Jordan.
And unpack that a little bit more with for those, you know, who are listening who aren't as familiar with, you know, some of these areas and the overall worldview there.
Well, when Israel declared independence in 1948 and they pushed a lot of Palestinians out, they pushed them into Jordan. So there's a huge ethnic bloc of Palestinians in Jordan, which is a Hashemite kingdom. And the fact that Jordan is being almost forced, arm-twisted, to take more Palestinians out of Gaza, which the Israelis have made uninhabitable, it makes them even weaker politically. And I can see the Turks stimulating additional Palestinian resentment, et cetera, and trying to absorb Jordan next.
So where do you think Eric Prince Trump is on all of this? I mean, you know, we know they met with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He's met with Zelensky. That didn't go all that well. But Zelensky's kind of, you know, crawling back with his tail tucked between his legs. But Trump, you know, is known for, obviously, for the art of the deal. He's a very commanding presence. I think the U.S. will be in a better position overall because of him. And we don't have Joe Biden, thankfully, in office, or Kamala Harris. But where do you see the U.S.'s involvement in negotiating some of this, both in Israel and then also the Ukraine-Russia conflict?
Look, I don't think the United States should be involved in Gaza. It's not our problem. Let the Israelis and their neighbors deal with it. I think the more the United States tries to attach themselves and make it our problem, Israel's problems are not our problems. You know, if you're going to have an America First foreign policy, make it America First. Israel is not our 51st state. Let them deal with it. We should not be on the hook for them financially or militarily or security-wise, period.
And, you know, and I have a little different take on that just from the Christian worldview perspective and the fact that, you know, obviously Israel was the victim of the October 7th attack. And I think we agree on that. I mean, obviously, this isn't about supporting Palestine or, you know, anything like that, how the headlines have tried to reverse that. But just from a perspective of Israel's entitlement to the land and how they have continued to have to be, you know, the victims of this ongoing conflict. I think that the United States has a command to at least be a friend to Israel. Whether or not we financially support them is a whole different question. But I think, you know, at least with the engagement and being an ally to Israel, that's going to continue under Trump. But we're, you know, potentially expanding on the Abraham Accords and some of this. If Trump continues to choose that path, which I think he will for perhaps different reasons than I see, where could the United States be involved that would ultimately have more of a peacekeeping solution or getting Israel to where it wants to be? And something, you know, like Mar-a-Gaza, I don't think is ultimately the answer. And I don't think that that's exactly where Trump is going when he makes that those kinds of statements. But where do you see Trump focusing in when he's wanting to be that ally to Israel?
I have no problem being a friend to Israel, trading with them, selling arms, etc. But I don't think they need to have a guaranteed multi-billion dollar gift from the American taxpayer every year to supplement their defense budget. And we certainly do not need to spend any money in rebuilding Gaza. Not our responsibility. We have $35 trillion in debt. We have plenty of issues here. If you're going to have an America First foreign policy, make it actually America First.
Yeah, and I'm speaking with Eric Prince, and I think that reevaluating how much money we spend to our allies is a fair position, and I'm with you on that, at least insofar as, you know, we're spending so much money under the auspices of what, you know, spreading democracy. I mean, that was kind of the term for a while, but we're spending all of this money overseas and obviously for other ridiculous things that Trump has identified, when we're not spending as much money as we should in America to help American causes. And we're also spending just too much money in general. I mean, when we have the tax rate for the federal income tax at such an exorbitant amount, I don't think that the average taxpayer would support any of this. And this is why there is the push for DOGE. So what's the balance here on the U.S. being involved, but in your view, at least, you know, scaling back largely a lot of these payments?
Let our allies be allies, but we don't have protectorates anymore.
And what do you mean by that?
In the same way that we expect NATO to pay and defend themselves and be an ally of the United States, in the same way we don't need to have a massive guaranteed grant to Israel every year. It's not that Israel doesn't have enough money. There is plenty of money in Israel, significant wealth in Israel and amongst the diaspora. It's a lot of clever lobbying that has stimulated that kind of checkbook, and I just don't agree with it anymore.
Well, and I think that view as well is largely where the conservative posture is at, especially on Ukraine. And I think that's, for Christians at least, that's a different topic than Israel. I mean, we can see clearly why, you know, all of this funding to Ukraine, because that whole conflict, I think, is a separate question than America's support for Israel. But I think at least insofar as, you know, America can support Israel without necessarily these types of payments or scaling back or at least reconsidering is a valid position. But I do think, at least from the Christian worldview perspective, I'm going to look at Israel differently than I'm going to look at that Ukraine and Russia and, you know, some of these other ways that we're spending dollars. So overall, though, in terms of, you know, where we're at with some of the Ukraine-Russia conflict, how do you see Trump potentially negotiating that? And I think that, you know, we shouldn't be involved in that, really, period. So I would kind of take what you said on Israel and apply that actually to Ukraine and Russia. But where do you see that situation going in the next short term?
Well, just for perspective, we've given more in the last 3 years to Ukraine than the entirety to the state of Israel. I think it's like $350 billion to Ukraine and about $320 billion to Israel over the duration of Israel. Both too much, way too much. I think Trump will end up pushing through a deal that will effectively freeze the lines, and the Russians will take the Russian-speaking areas, and Ukraine will not be part of NATO, and there'll be some kind of mineral deal, which is good because it'll guarantee commercial access points. So you'll have Americans in Ukraine, but they'll be doing mining in resource extraction, not there as a military garrison.
All right. Well, Eric Prince, really appreciate your comments this morning. He's founder of Blackwater, and you can always follow him on X. I'd encourage you to do that. So, you know, some interesting perspectives, and I love hearing from guests, you know, some different perspectives, because I think it is a valid position that we should review all of the money that we are sending to, you know, any foreign nation, or where we're spending it even domestically. Because, you know, again, if we are taking taxpayer money to things that the taxpayers aren't actually benefiting from and that aren't in America's interest, then that is called theft. And this is why I hope that the whole income tax scheme is going to be reviewed and hopefully revised. But just from a biblical worldview perspective, the United States supporting Israel, I think, is a very different moral posture than when we look at the conflict in Ukraine and Russia. And, you know, and as Tim Wildman and I talked about on Today's Issues last week, you know, his perspective on the moral grounding, because, you know, Ukraine was attacked. I mean, there is a moral question there, but at least from a biblical, you know, Abrahamic covenant sort of view that goes beyond just one isolated terror incident. My view on America supporting Israel is that it's because ultimately we're supporting God and his promises, where that has nothing to do with the Ukraine-Russia conflict. So we need to parse these from the American position, but also from a biblical perspective. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna@AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.